toss out a word here? Rigged. Pretty sure you've heard that lately in the context of the election. And to be clear, it is extraordinarily unlikely, almost impossible, that a modern U.S. election could be rigged. What I'm talking about, actually, is the economy and our perception of it. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And here's the thing. Despite widespread data that tells us we are in an economic recovery, roughly two-thirds of Americans, regardless of party, say the economy is rigged. And most of us think it's to the benefit of the rich or big corporations. That's a finding from our Marketplace Edison research poll. You heard some of that last week, and we've got more for you today, which we are exploring. Plus, stories from Americans about their own personal economies, and a few of your thoughts. As always, come share them with us at Marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But first, we're going to start the show, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance and ask our guests to go long, bet on, or short, bet against, topics in the news and the world of business. And this week, I'm joined by two friends of the show, Sam Grobart, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and Gillian White, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you guys back on the show. And since we like to go long and short, let's get them out of the gate. Gillian, what is your long?
My long is paying attention to the underbanked and unbanked populations of the United States.
Well, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, right? So the FDIC on Thursday released a report about the underbanked and unbanked populations of the United States. And they've only been tracking it since like 2009. But they found that the unbanked population, which is Americans who don't have any relationship with a traditional bank account, has dropped to 7%, which is the lowest that it's been the entire time they've tracked it, which is great. But the underbanked population, which is, you know, north of 20 million people who have a checking account but use things like pawn shops or auto title loans or payday loans, that remains basically where it's been this entire time. The reason that I'm long on talking about this is because there's been so much attention around this. I've seen more coverage of this FDIC survey than I have in a really long time. So it makes me really hopeful that the word is getting out and that maybe some product solutions are on the way.
Is this something where we've seen any impact from the existence of, say, the CFPB, which after all was created after the financial crisis, or are those kind of separate things?
No, so they are definitely related. One of the cool things is that two of the big issues that the underbanked and unbanked deal with, so that's payday loans, small installment loans that have really, really high interest rates and can sometimes be predatory, that is something that the CFPB has made rules on. And then another thing that this most recent FDIC survey found was that a lot of people who don't have bank accounts are relying on prepaid debit cards. And that is something that the CFPB just came out with new rules for because people were being charged crazy fees for things like just checking their balance, things that you don't have to worry about if you have a bank debit card. The thing that we really need to see some change on is actual products that will fill this gap. There's obviously a ton of demand for these type of services, but traditional banks are still not providing them.
Turning this station wagon from ways of saving money, thinking about money to, I guess, what, spending money, Sam?
Oh, that's what I love to do.
Yeah.
So I am long on new menswear companies. You know, it wasn't that long ago, if you were a guy, you might go shopping at a sort of usual suspects of shops that might include J. Crew, Brooks Brothers, maybe like you go to the mall and get something at Polo. And nowadays, more men are flocking to brand new companies or relatively brand new, like Bonobos or J. Hilburn or Jack Irwin. And they're all similar in that they basically have gotten rid of any major retail presence. So they're not worried about.
So they have low overhead.
They have low overhead. They're not worried about big rents or anything like that. They may have a couple of like showrooms, but those places actually don't keep any inventory. You can go there to try things on, but they are still primarily an online business.
Gillian, since you're in a remote studio, I have to tell you that I'm sitting in front of Sam right now and he's wearing like a pink and blue and white checkered shirt situation.
Which I purchased online.
Oh, okay. All right.
Exactly. Exactly. So they've just managed to like find these supply chain efficiencies and bring them to bear on this market. And I think that given all of the convenience plus the lower prices, I would be very long these companies and resultingly kind of short on the traditional men's labels unless they happen to get wise and jump on this bandwagon.
All right. If consumers are buying things, theoretically, that would contribute to our gross domestic product, which takes us to Jillian Short.
Well, my short is unfortunately debate related. The final presidential debate happened. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief. Yeah. And during it, when they were talking about GDP growth and how they would fix the economy, which was pretty short-lived, Donald Trump said that GDP has been growing really slowly. True.
Yeah.
But then compared our GDP to India's and said that he was confident that he could get GDP growth to 5-6. He might have gone as high as 7%.
Oh, he left it open. He said, oh, it could be even higher.
I don't even know. That is not a thing. The reason that developing countries have had such high GDP growth is because they are developing. They have a lower economic output base to start from. So, of course, their economic activity is going to produce a higher growth rate. We are not a developing economy, so
nor do we want to be in a place where we're growing at a 7% clip. That is actually the sort of stuff where people talk about overheating and hard landings.
Right. And also that means if you're in those developing economies, it's like you have that growth, but you may not have indoor plumbing.
Yeah. And I'm concerned about what would have had to happen to the U.S. economy for those to be produced.
I think we can all get behind that short.
I felt like when I heard that in the debate, I wanted to lean into the microphone and say, wrong.
Oh, boy. All right, Sam, take us out with your short.
I am short Microsoft's two-year misadventure in the NFL. Back in 2014, the company with great fanfare said that every team in the NFL, every coach, every sideline person is going to get a Microsoft Surface tablet. And oh, my gosh, it's going to be so much better than all the clunky binders and paperwork they used to work with to check plays and so forth. Well, recently, New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick, in a press conference, was unusually talkative about this topic and explained that he was no longer going to be using the tablets because they just plain don't work and they're unreliable and paper was never a problem before and he's returning to it. And this is a bit of a black eye for Microsoft and its Surface, which has always had a bit of a rocky road to begin with. And now just has another sort of embarrassing moment to contend with.
But I feel like this is not a totally unusual theme for Microsoft, where they seem to do very well in business-driven products, things that companies use, but consumer-facing, and
right.
This is a very high-profile consumer-facing piece of technology.
That's right. I mean, the enterprise side of Microsoft's business has always been performing very well. And so when it comes to sort of back office and server farm kind of stuff, the company is excellent. But look at the Zune, look at the Surface. It remains to be seen if they can really pull off a good product that people really like.
Sam Grobart from Bloomberg Businessweek, Jillian White from The Atlantic. Thank you both as always.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Back to that perception of the economy thing. Yes, we measure how we're doing by statistics like GDP, which we just talked about. But as anyone with a paycheck or bills knows, those big, broad measures don't always reflect everyone's experience, how the economy feels in your house. That's why we've been collecting stories for a while now from people all over the country. We call it My Economy. Today, we hear from a single mom taking a big leap of faith to pursue her dreams.
My name is Wendy Wagoner, and I am from a suburb of Louisville, Kentucky. I'm in Georgetown, Indiana. I'm 47 years old, and I am a social worker for a drug and alcohol prevention and treatment agency. I have three children. They're all boys, and they are 18, 15, and 11. Probably bring home somewhere around $30,000 a year. When I was married, we had a very good income. I was married to someone that was an attorney, made really good money. So we had a very comfortable lifestyle. But since becoming a single mom, that has changed a lot. A few years ago, I decided that, you know, this financial situation that I'm in was having a hard time seeing how I would ever get to a different place financially. And so a long time ago, my original dream and my original goal was to become a doctor. I had given up on that years ago, but it started coming back to me over the last few years. Like, I wonder if I could still do that. It was almost like I kind of gave myself permission to dream again about something for myself. And I decided to go for it. Started school a little over a year ago, and it's gone remarkably well, and I should be matriculating into medical school next year. Supporting myself while I'm in school is definitely going to be a challenge. I am on a quest right now trying to figure out the answer to that question. It's everything from looking at borrowing the money, if it's even a possibility, and just the plan being, when I get done with this, I will have the income to be able to pay it back. Selling my house, you know, that's a big step to take. That's a lot of changes for me and the kids, but my kids have been just incredibly supportive. They're my biggest cheerleaders. So my oldest son is getting ready to go to college himself. He's going to be a freshman at Indiana University, and he is interested in the field of medicine as well. We have a little friendly competition going on to race each other through medical school and see which one of us can finish first.
A couple of weekends from now, we will be, in theory, talking about a newly elected president. This past week's debate let the candidates make their final arguments, and we want to look at those, but also this sense of economic unease that still permeates the country. Our Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook, is here to help guide us. Hello, Andrea.
Hi.
All right, so I mentioned that word rigged, and you know, it has come up a lot. I want to get a sense from you of why this notion of an election, or really in our world, an economy being rigged, resonates so much.
Well, you know, this is a theme that we here at Marketplace have been taking on this election cycle. I think that you can sort of define the world these days between people who feel like they are insiders and people who feel like they are outsiders. That's true in politics, it's true in access to government, but it's really true in terms of the economy. And it reflects this growing understanding of the incredible income inequality that we have in this country. And so people look at the economy and they say, you know, gosh, why does this person, you know, make so much more money than I do, or it just sort of has access to making money when I'm scrambling around trying to find someone to take care of my kids so I can go to my job, that sort of thing. So when the word rigged started coming up, we were very surprised in the Marketplace polls at how many Americans said that the economy is rigged, or they believe the economy is rigged. And so this, in this latest wave of our poll, we dug down a little bit and found that there is a lot of agreement among Americans that that it is rigged towards the rich, towards corporations, towards politicians. But after that, the two sides, those who support Clinton and those who support Trump, differ wildly on who think the rigged is for. Yeah, the Trump supporters tend to think that the economy is rigged towards immigrants. Clinton supporters do not think that nearly as much anyway. Many fewer supporters think that. And then conversely, Clinton supporters tend to think that the economy is rigged towards white people, and Trump supporters do not think that. Trump supporters tend to think that the economy is rigged towards people on public assistance. Clinton supporters do not think that. So that's really a, you know, the numbers that show the thought profile of your average Clinton supporter and Trump supporter.
You are laying out these starkly different perceptions of the U.S. economy. So I guess I wonder at this point, who is still undecided and what are they undecided about?
It's a really good question. I always get to this place every single presidential election where, you know, you're a couple weeks out and you say, my God, who is still undecided at this point? But, you know, not everybody watches everything obsessively the way some of us might. I think really the people who are undecided this cycle, though, are people who can't stand either candidate. Let's just say it like that. You know, I mean, there are so many people who can't stand Trump and can't stand Clinton. And it's really the unfavorables are striking. And those people are sitting around going like, gosh, what do I do? I can't not vote. Or at least the people who always vote, they don't know what to do. So, you know, I know a lot of people who are going to write in, you know, their dad or vote for one of the third party candidates. And I think those are really the undecided people in this election.
Let's do a tiny bit of truth squatting here. And I know it's hard to ask you to pick one. But if you could pick one, but if you could pick one economic narrative that is false that each candidate has put forward, call them out.
All right. All right. I think I can't pick one. Actually, with Trump, I will say there's a couple of things that have been kind of gobsmacking. One is that he will be able to push the economy to 4% growth in his first year. That would require every American to go out and buy a new car in January. Every single American to buy a new car to get that kind of rev up in growth is all but impossible. Something wild would have to happen. It's not going to happen. Another one that he says over and over again is that the Fed is keeping interest rates low to help Obama politically. And that is just so inaccurate. No one thinks that's true. These are the kinds of things that even his supporters kind of distance themselves from, even Mike Pence. On the Clinton side, I think, you know, she's a lot more careful. She's a much she's a politician of many years, as we know. But I think the thing that she says most often is that nothing she does will add a penny to the debt. Now, I think where that's inaccurate is that it's a very nuanced thing to say. Of course, things that are going to happen, things that would happen under a Clinton presidency will add to the debt because we have such a huge budget deficit, you know, the difference between what we spend and what we take in. And she's saying it won't add a penny more than it already does to the debt. And so
to those projections that are being made.
Exactly. It's a very nuanced idea and one that she gets away with saying we're not going to add a penny to the debt only because of the sort of quirks of that kind of statistic.
Andrea Seabrook, our Washington Bureau Chief, as always, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Lizzie.
Last year on this show, we broadcast an interview with a guy who said this about America's bail system.
I'm trying to be appropriate, but yes, I believe it is totally ass backwards, 100%.
That was, believe it or not, the former chief judge of New York State, Jonathan Lipman. He's retired from the bench now after trying to reform the use of cash bail, which has been a pretty hot topic lately. Several states have done away with commercial bail entirely, and even the Justice Department has argued against it. It's hard to say how many people stay in jail because they can't afford bail. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this story of one New York man whose arrest and inability to pay bail nearly wrecked his life.
So back in November of 2014, Ed, we're not using his real name because of unique details of his case, he was 31 years old and he was riding his bike by his housing complex in the Bronx.
Got off the bike, I parked it right there, and I sat down.
He's checking Facebook, and he sees two officers across the street.
2 minutes later, they walked over to me. He's like, oh, let me see your ID. I told him I live here. I gave it to him. That's what they tell you, that, you know, you comply. That's what I did. I mean, he didn't even look at it, my name or nothing. He just put it in his front pocket get on the wall. So I'm like, what did I do? I didn't do anything.
What Ed had done, technically, was ride his bike on the sidewalk for a few seconds, which is illegal in New York. He also questioned the cops, which he says enraged them.
So I was like, I did Youth Police Academy. You know, I know the procedure. And that was not it. I said, excuse me, why am I getting locked up for riding a bike?
Ed was charged with riding a bike on the sidewalk, resisting arrest, and assaulting a police officer, even though he says all he did was ride his bike and ask questions. His bail was set.
$1,500.
The charge of assaulting a police officer was dropped, and the bail was reduced to $500. Now, at the time, Ed was selling tickets for tour buses for work, living paycheck to paycheck, not making a whole lot.
In a month, probably like, let's see, $600.
In New York, when bail is set at just $500, only 17% of people pay it. Ed certainly could not. He stayed in jail.
It's like you're kidnapped. It smells worse than a hospital. It's like a dirty hospital.
There are thousands of people sitting in jail on minor cases, essentially because they are poor. And because they're poor, they can't afford the bail.
David Feige is chairman of the board of the Bronx Freedom Fund. They post bail for low-income people. Bail's effect on poor people is a problem that charities and several state governments have increasingly tried to grapple with in recent years. The U.S. Department of Justice has argued that fixed money bail for poor people violates their 14th Amendment rights to equal protection. While in jail, Ed lost his job.
It's been 8 days. The days was going by. And like, if you have a job, if you're missing for 2 days, you don't longer have a job. You got to pay rent by the week. Your life is in the tailspin.
Now, Ed can actually get out of jail anytime he wants. All he has to do is plead guilty. No need for a drawn-out trial. They'll just fine him and release him with a record.
So it's like, oh, you're going to take the deal for your freedom? But I'm like, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything. I know in my heart.
So Ed stays in jail.
If you're incarcerated, you're faced with the Hobson's choice. Plead guilty and get out of jail, or maintain your innocence and stay in.
Feige says statistics show not everyone sticks to their guns like Ed when faced with this choice.
The folks that we're unable to post bail for, essentially 100% of them, very close to 100% of them, wind up pleading guilty. Once we post bail, more than 50% of the cases in which we post bail are dismissed, outright, just dismissed.
The Bronx Freedom Fund ended up posting Ed's bail for him, and he showed up to court more than a dozen times as his case wound through the system. Feige says it's an illusion that bail is the only thing keeping people accused of low-level crimes from skipping court.
We post bail, everybody still comes back. Our return rates are 97%.
Bail is being unfairly painted as sort of a debtor's prison issue.
Jeff Clayton is policy director of the American Bail Coalition, a trade association. He says the number of people in jail because they can't afford bail is overstated and believes bail is ultimately fair.
Bail is a liberty promotion institution as old as this nation.
There are around 450,000 Americans in jail who haven't been convicted of a crime. How many of them are there because they are poor is hotly contested and varies from place to place. Data from L.A. suggests it's 14% there. A New Jersey study from 2013 put the number at 39%. Advocates say it's higher. By any measure, it's tens of thousands of people on any given day. In the end, Ed's case was dismissed. All of it. The bike riding, the resisting arrest. In the 2 years it took to clear his name, he had 2 job offers rescinded because of his still open record. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Whether you are splurging on candy or spending a few extra bucks on a costume, spending on Halloween has gone up, at least according to retailers. The National Retail Federation estimates that the average American will spend $82 this year on the holiday. Last year, it was $74. And over the past few weeks, we've been hearing from listeners about their own Halloween budgets. Forrest Swick is 49. He lives in Evans, Colorado. And in a typical Halloween night, he can get, well, lots of trick-or-treaters.
I went back through my Facebook post from a few years ago, and in 2009, I wrote in there, we have a new record. We broke the old ones of 450 and 500. Now it's 600-plus trick-or-treaters, and we just ran out of candy, and then we had the first trick-or-treater showing up at 425 in the afternoon. 2011, it said 600-plus treaters, no tricksters. 2012, I had written out there 800 kids. It's not 7:30 yet. And then last year I had written a note that said we had 315. So
wow. How much does it cost to buy candy for all of these trick-or-treaters?
That's a good question. I really don't know how much the cost is because we just, the first few years we were there, we obviously had to, turn our lights off early, but we just, whatever the bags are, we keep all of the candy in like a little witch's cauldron, a plastic, it's probably like a 5 or 6 gallon jug, and we just fill that up, and as kids come, we give them out one, and there are adults who come through and teenagers as well, so.
Do you have a sense, like, how many bags of candy you have purchased this year? Like, what you're laying in for this year's Halloween?
We'll probably shoot for, 800 or 900 would be my guess. It obviously would be 16 bags candy that are 50 pieces per, I don't even know how many is in a bag anymore. I guess we just go in and the grocery store and check it out to see what we have. Like you said, it's crazy having that many people show up.
Well, Forrest, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
You're welcome.
Then there's Eric Serwin. He's 34, lives in Rockford, Illinois. Every year, his wife tries to save money on Halloween by making their kids' costumes herself. One year, she made an R2-D2 costume for their son using a laundry basket and a yoga ball.
I'm not convinced that it saves us any money. Because I know, like, buying off the rack, you can buy some cheapy costumes for 10, 20 bucks. And sometimes when she goes to make things, she'll have an idea in her head and she really wants to make it happen. And she's very creative that way. So she'll start adding to it and then she'll need to buy a little piece for this or go to the craft store and get some puff paint. By the time it adds up, I'm sitting there looking at it like, well, I think that costs a lot more than a costume off the rack, but it looks so good. And that R2-D2 costume, like that one, I know she spent more than she'll ever tell me. But it looked so amazing, especially like, because he would stand up and his head would pop up and it was just a huge hit. Everyone in the neighborhood loved it.
What are your kids going as this year?
I don't know yet. And I have to tell you, so she does these costumes maybe the last week. That's how my wife works. It's like Lucille Ball. She'll take over the whole living room for 3 days putting these things together. And I've learned to just keep my mouth shut and let it happen.
All right. Well, then let me throw this one to you. Since you're the one who likes to stay home and pass out candy, like, do you have an estimate of how much you guys spend on, say, candy for the neighborhood trick-or-treaters?
Yeah, very little. I spend maybe like 20 bucks every now and then. If I have a few extra bucks, I'll go to Sam's and buy a box of full-size candy bars for the kids that I know, not just random kids.
Wow. You came in way under a lot of the people who wrote us on Facebook.
Yeah. I don't know if we just don't have that many kids coming through or if they just... they're more accepting of like just a piece at a time. But I hate spending a lot of money on candy.
Fair enough. One last question for you. Do you dress up?
I have not dressed up in years.
Eric.
I feel bad. I was the Phantom of the Opera for about 6 years when I was a kid. And then I grew up and I gave up on it.
Fair enough, man. I hope you can hear the note of disappointment in my voice.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Maybe this year I'll have to dress up just for you.
Thank you. Eric Serwin, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Last, we've got Layla Corsero. She's 48, lives in Sacramento, California. And when it comes to spending on Halloween, she gets creative.
The bad candy like Smarties or Tootsie Rolls goes back into our bowl that we offer to other kids. And we just keep his favorites like Reese's, M&M's, and Snickers.
So you're sort of stealth candy recyclers. You're cycling out the stuff that's not your son's favorite.
Exactly. And maybe my husband will get some, too.
Are you someone who makes costumes, buys costumes? How do you handle that?
No, I buy costumes. And sometimes I try to reuse them if it still fits. And luckily, last year, he wanted to be a caveman. So the only one I found was an adult size. And now he's only 13, so it still fits. So the only change that we're making is that what used to be the beard for the costume, now it's going to be his hair. Yeah, it looks pretty darn cute.
I'm just curious, are you a normally sort of clever and thrifty person, or is this just applied to Halloween?
I'm not very thrifty, but I try to save where I don't care, and I splurge on the things that I really like. So I buy 2 bags of candy. I recycle what he gets, and it usually works every year.
Layla, thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem. Thank you.
Next week, we are going to keep things election-focused. And so we want to know, what economic questions do you want answered before you vote? Let us know. We are here to explain. Visit marketplace.org, go to our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. We have a rare look now, brought to us by our partners at the BBC, into life under ISIS control. The battle for the Iraqi city of Mosul began this week. Several thousand people have escaped the city as Iraqi and Kurdish forces advance on it. But the hundreds of thousands of people still living there are telling their stories in a different way. By contacting a radio station based in nearby Erbil, set up to get news in and out of Mosul. Unlike callers to traditional talk radio, they are risking their lives to air their views and pass on the news. BBC reporter Mike Thompson has been listening to some of the calls.
Ever since Mosul fell to IS or Daesh, little has been heard from those inside, as this resident testifies.
I've been trapped inside Mosul for 2 years and 3 months. We're totally isolated here. I know nothing about what's happening in the world outside.
But for well over a year now, Radio Al-Gad FM, part funded by exiled Kurdish politicians, has been getting news into this frightened city. And getting news out, too, via phone calls, often at great risk to those making them. Its founder is Mohammed Al-Mawzali, a computer engineering graduate from Mosul University.
Usually, if you call a radio station, that's normal call. But in our case, somebody is risking his life. It's a death penalty in case if they found anybody who's trying to call the outside world, because they will assume he's cooperating with the coalition. And Daesh recently been breaking into homes looking for GSM SIM cards and looking for cell phones.
I'm not afraid, because this is the voice of truth and justice. We have suffered enough. Others want to phone in, but they tell me they are too scared. I tell them not to be scared.
It's clear from callers that the closer Iraqi forces and their allies get to Mosul, the less IS is feared.
It's Daesh that should be scared of the security forces. We're not scared of them anymore. The fear that people had of them is gone. Nobody cares anymore about Daesh. Most of them have vanished. We saw a change in them today. They have started hiding their faces again, wearing masks. I've been walking around the city, and I can tell you that there are far fewer Daesh than before. They are filling the old cars or caravans with explosives and leaving. A whole group of the caravans and cars have headed outside of Mosul. We saw them leaving with their families.
As the operation to retake Mosul continues at speed, there are claims that IS's leader, al-Baghdadi, is holed up somewhere in the city, an idea dismissed by this caller.
As for those who say that their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has escaped the city, we never saw him anyway. He's more of a ghost figure than anything. He came to Mosul once to deliver his infamous speech, but hasn't been seen here since.
Despite the battle raging outside the city, callers from Mosul have been talking of a surprising lack of activity within its walls over the last few days.
Life at the moment in Mosul is sort of at a standstill. There are no cars on the streets and most shops have closed. Civilians here are being really careful. They're trying not to leave their homes. Even the number of cars used by murderous Daesh are fewer than before. We're seeing more of them using motorbikes instead to get around the city. Daesh has been busy preparing landmines. They're placing them inside cars and putting containers full of explosives on most main roads within the city.
The situation is currently very quiet inside Mosul. When I went outside my house, just after noon, there was no sight of Daesh people on the streets.
They're finished and they know it. They don't know what to do. The resistance brigades are hitting them hard. Daesh is finished now, with God's will.
This online propaganda video, one of several posted recently by IS, depicts them fighting back hard. But Mohammed al-Mawsali believes they'd much rather do battle in Mosul, using civilians as shields from the bombs and the bullets.
I have a lot of concerns about the liberation, because I know it's not going to be an easy liberation, because I'm afraid that Daesh want to have a trap for the troops coming to Mosul. They would prefer to fight inside the city. Then you have 2 million, they will be a human shields. Also, Daesh have some places they've been prepared for this moment.
This might help explain why thousands of civilians have been pouring out of Mosul. But this caller insists many there now fear their liberators almost as much as their oppressors.
I just want to deliver a message to the Iraqi security forces. We have been waiting for you for 2 years now, and we hope you can liberate us. But please, take care of our innocent civilians inside the city. A lot of people have heard that some of your security forces plan to take revenge against civilians when they enter. And that scares people here in Mosul.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC. By some estimates, about 100 million Americans have an iPhone. And if you are one of them, you are used to getting iOS software update notifications. You know, the little things that tell you to install the new operating system? Well, recently, that is iOS 10. But this is something that lots of tech companies do. And they do it all the time. And it's not something consumers always like. So we brought on Marketplace's senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, to help us understand why we need all these updates. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Lizzie.
This conversation with you started as something personal I noticed, which was, you know, I updated my iPhone to the next operating system, and I'm clueless. I can't use it. And so yeah. At a risk of turning my own personal inept nature into a news story, why does this happen? Why do companies, for lack of a better term, fix things that aren't broken?
It's not just your ineptitude. You are not alone in your feelings about iOS 10 in particular. In fact, I will tell you on a personal note that I recently went over to a friend's house and just sort of casually started talking about it. And he said, wait, just stop. I'm going to go get my phone. And we had like a 35-minute session just complaining about these changes in iOS 10. And some of it is deserved, but I think this is the point where I have to say that some of it is not. You know, we'll use Apple as the example in this case. They're still trying to figure out a design language for all of the things that our devices can increasingly do. Like if you look across iOS 10, there are multiple instances where they have two actions doing the same thing. And of course, that's going to confuse a user. For example, like if you double tap the home button, if you tap it kind of quickly, it brings up the wallet where you have your stored credit cards and boarding right. passes. But if you tap it two times slowly, it brings you your unlock screen. And
this is a real
crazy.
Particular problem I've been having. Yeah.
Right. I'm willing to acknowledge that some of the changes are in service of unlocking more capability. And then some of them just seem like letting people try stuff that didn't work out, which is always the case.
So our phones are obviously such a huge part of our life now, as you mentioned. Is there a competitive strategy on the part of an Apple or a Samsung or a Google, whatever, that we as consumers aren't seeing that is going on behind the scenes as all of these updates happen?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not just limited to phones. You know, if you do a Google search for superficial interface changes, you will see people complaining about Facebook. You'll see them complaining about their bank apps. And there are two things happening. One, yes, there is absolutely a competitive strategy. It is tied to that idea of unlocking more features. It's tied to the ability to introduce new functionality. It is tied to, in some cases, addressing consumer complaints, right? We have been complaining to Facebook or to Apple about this, that, or the other thing. They try to fix it. Interfaces are very hard, and it's hard to get people to change their behaviors. There does need to be a little bit more discipline, I think, in the tech community about the changes that they choose to make. But I will say that even though it drives me crazy, there is usually a reason.
And I assume eventually we just sort of go, okay, fine, and get used to it.
Eventually we get used to it. Look, my personal opinion is that iOS 10 is not a good update. There are many things about it that are malformed. And I think more than any update I can remember in recent years, it's designed for the new hardware. And that's why it's so frustrating to people who are updating as opposed to getting it on a brand new iPhone 7 or new or even iPhone 6S. But yeah, we'll get used to it. And then we'll complain again when they change it. That's just the circle of tech life.
If we zoom out a little bit and look at these companies that are jockeying for market share, for differentiation, you know, for our dollars and our eyeballs, our worlds have become so saturated with tech products. Does it take more, do you think, to control a consumer's attention right now, you know, in order to get us to spend money to put that thing in, you know, somebody's birthday or Christmas present?
I think it does. And I think that's exactly where the dilemma comes in, because on the one hand, you know, so much of these interactions are new. So companies are working it out on the fly. But our consumer expectation is that it will be perfect. I think you have seen, especially in recent years in the tech industry, a real rise in the concept of design and design thinking, and not just how things look, but how they operate from the very first interaction that a consumer has all the way to the end, making it so seamless, so easy that it seems like it reads your mind. But of course, as you can imagine, the process of actually accomplishing that is really hard.
So what's the conversation that's going on behind closed doors at one of these companies right now?
If the conversation is going well, then it involves listening to consumers and trying to get inside their heads about the way that they think and the way they operate. It's about creating a model for behavior that is actually based on what people want to do. If the conversation is not going well, then it's happening in a vacuum, and it involves a bunch of product managers arguing with each other about the way they like to do things.
Molly Wood, as always, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
No matter who you are, you've probably had a rough day at the office that changed your perspective. Or maybe you made an impulse purchase you really, really wish you could take back. Just about everybody stumbles somewhere along the way, and that's why we have the Marketplace Quiz. It's our money-inspired questionnaire that we give to actors, musicians, and other people in the spotlight. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
Hi, my name is Devendra Banhart, and I'm on the Marketplace Quiz. Thanks for having me.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
It can lead to total dissatisfaction and the realization that money can't buy you happiness. I think you can live your whole life just trying to make more and more and more and more. But if you can create a little bit of space between that delusion that it's going to lead to happiness,
mm-hmm.
you can reach a moment where you go, oh, this really doesn't lead to happiness. So now I'm going to pursue what does.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, money does lead to happiness.
All right, you've proved us wrong. In a next life, what would your career be?
In the next life, what would my career be? Easy. Dried persimmon dealer. Now, if it was, that's if it's limited to a human life. If it's not, then I'll go with seaweed. I've always thought it'd be nice to be seaweed, kind of just floating about.
Wow.
Within that same kind of maritime theme, blue whale would be pretty fantastic.
When did you realize that being a musician could be an actual career?
When my family heard me sing my first song that I wrote when I was around 9 or 10 years old in Caracas.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those Sundays when we had dinner, we would have lunch, and lunch at my grandmother's house, and so the uncles were there, my cousins were there, my grandmother, and they were all sitting in the little living room, and I said, okay, I wrote a song, I'd like to present it, and I sang it to them. And it was the look of horror on their faces. It was the request to never do that again that made me think, ooh, okay, this might be something I want to pursue.
Do you remember the first time you got paid to perform?
The first paid show was in Los Angeles at an art opening, and I was paid maybe, I don't know, maybe $25.
Yeah.
And but that pride, which was that was a big deal, mm-hmm. but all of it was literally annihilated by the fact that while I was playing, I hear somebody yell, like, shut the F up, really loud. Oh, it kind of shocked me. I started crying. I mean, I was really
on stage?
Because the person kept doing it, of course. And but then the show was over, and I felt like, okay, now I know what that's like. And it turns out that my friend Anti had paid this guy to do that, and he filmed it.
That's really cruel.
And at first, that's what I thought, too. Later on, I was so grateful, because I kind of, you know, got to experience that. And yet, I also had the kind of ego padding of mm-hmm. knowing that, well, he didn't really mean it. My friend paid him, you know what I mean? So uh-huh. it was kind of a strange gift.
What was your first job?
My first job was shoveling in a farm in El Junquito. So it's kind of farmlands of Venezuela, and there was a farm that my mom was friends with, the farm woman. She thought it'd be good for me to spend the summer there working on the farm. But my first paid job was bagging groceries at a market called Westward Ho. Doesn't exist anymore in California.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Three things come to mind.
Okay.
A Nobel Peace Prize, chapstick, and universal compassion.
Some of those things are free.
Your chapstick, you mean, right?
Yeah, the chapstick's free, right? You can just take that from any CVS without paying.
If you're bagging groceries at Westward Ho, yeah.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
It's okay to not know, and it's okay to ask for help.
Do you feel like you did those things when you started out?
No, I feel like it was all about, no, I know, and I don't need anyone's help. I need to prove that I can be independent. But that isn't really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely don't know everything. And not only that, but it's okay not to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And asking for help doesn't suddenly make you intrinsically dependent or codependent. It's a dance.
Devendra Banhart's album Ape in Pink Marble is out now. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we are here to answer your pre-election economic questions. What do you want answered in the world of economics before you vote? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Vanessa Smith and by Haley Hirschman, who once dressed as a tax auditor for Halloween because it was the scariest thing she could think of. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Norin Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.